There was a man who bought a donkey from an old farmer for $100. And the farmer agreed to deliver the donkey the next day. The following day, the farmer drove up and said, "Look, I'm sorry, but I've got some bad news. The donkey died last night." "Well then," said the man, "just give me my money back then." "I can't do that, sir," he said. "I've already spent the money." "Oh well," he says, "just unload that donkey." "What are you going to do with him?" Obviously he wasn't a good Uniting Church person. He said, "I'm going to raffle him off." He said, "You can't raffle off a dead donkey." "Well, that's where you're wrong. You wait and see." A month later, the farmer ran into the man and he asked, "So what happened to that dead donkey?" "I raffled that donkey off. I sold 500 tickets at $2 each and I made $998. "Didn't anyone complain?" "Well, just the guy who won." "So I gave him his $2 back." Ah, greed. Comes in all forms. Last week we looked at the first of the parables that we are considering in this series. We looked at the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I presented to you an alternative way to consider the meaning of that parable, rather than seeing it just as a moral issue of seeing all people as our neighbours and doing good to all. Today, as we look at this parable known as the parable of the rich fool, as it's been traditionally named, although in the story, in light of the story, I think it would be better if we call this parable the farm that owned a fool. Who owns who? Do we own our wealth? Do we own our possessions? Or do they own us? Unlike last week's parable, I see this one as being pretty much straightforward. The meaning and the message are fairly obvious. Not that it is any easier to internalise, for the message is rather direct and rather challenging. And the parable is triggered by a comment made to Jesus. A man in the crowd calls out to Jesus and says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide with me the property that our father left us." Now that certainly seems a rather odd request, asking Jesus to intervene in what is most likely to be some kind of legal dispute. The clue to why Jesus was asked is found in the form of address given by the man when he called him a teacher or a rabbi. Because the rabbis, you see, were responsible for dealing with just such matters. Normally, the eldest son in the family received twice as much as the younger brother and likely acted as an administrator of the estate. So presumably, the guy making the request to Jesus is the younger brother who thought that he was being cheated in this carve-up. Or maybe he thought the older brother was too slow in acting. We don't really know, because the actual details of the dispute are not given here. But Jesus clearly does not believe it is his responsibility to get involved in such matters, and he tells him as much. "My friend, who gave me the right to judge or divide the property between you two?" That said, Jesus then seizes the opportunity to address those who are listening, his followers and others around. And he warns them against greed and the assumption that life's meaning and success is based on the abundance of possessions. Jesus said to his hearers, "Watch out and guard yourselves against every form of greed, because a person's true life is not made up of things that he owns, no matter how rich he may be." It never ceases to amaze me how relevant and contemporary the scriptures are. These words could have been penned yesterday, couldn't they? It seems that some things just don't change. We live in a society when if you are rich, then you are really considered to be a somebody. People are sometimes described by their net worth. And they're talking in monetary terms. Their worth is in what they own, which is in fact a very poor way to measure a person's worth. Our value is not in what we own. Our value is in what Jesus thinks of us. But I digress. A few years ago, we visited England. And I was staggered by the opulence and the size of the stately homes and palaces that are scattered throughout the country. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about if you've visited. It's not until you actually see these places and walk through them that you begin to comprehend just how ridiculous and impractical these places really are to live in. Why were they built with such grandeur? The answer I received when I asked the question was that they were built simply as status symbols to display to the society the great wealth and the importance of the one who lived there. The grander the home, the higher the status. You see, having it all really made you somebody. And it seems it still does today. We hear about the rich list, the top 50. But we never hear about the poor list, the bottom 50. Obviously, there are too many to choose from. But still, why this oppression with the richest? Okay, I get it. Most of you aren't interested in such a list. But the fact that such lists are made indicates that some people are very interested. Success is defined by having the biggest and the best and the most. And like the houses that I saw in England, the wealth that some people have accumulated seems ridiculous in the extreme. I wonder why they need so much when most of us can get by with a little less. Surely this passage in Luke is just what some people need to hear. But hang on a minute. Before we point the finger, I think if we are honest, we all find ourselves living in some form of tension with this passage. It's not just the insanely rich who are being challenged here. Watch out and guard yourself from every form of greed, because a person's true life is not made up of the things he or she owns, no matter how rich he or she may be. Having warned his followers with this statement, Jesus then tells the story. There was once a rich man who had land which bore good crops. Such was the return from the land that the man was faced with a dilemma. There was more produce than he could possibly cope with. His barns were stuffed to overflowing. What should he do? Dilemma of dilemmas. And he quickly works out a response to the problem. Does he think of ways that he could offer some of his bounty to others and share his wealth? No. Does he give thanks to God for all that he's received? Does he see that he has simply been blessed with a very good growing season? No. Does he recognize the contribution of his many farmhands who slavishly worked the land and painstakingly harvested the crops? Does he offer a bonus? No. This man thinks of no one but himself. This man actually talks to no one but himself. Did you note that? Listen to all the personal pronouns, the I and the my words in these few sentences. I haven't anywhere to keep all of my crops. What can I do? This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones where I will store my corn and my other goods. Then I will say to myself, gee, that's 11 personal pronouns out of 45 words. And in the Greek, the ratio is even smaller. But he's not finished thinking about himself yet. For what purpose does he come up with his grand idea? Still speaking to himself, he says something like, lucky man. Lucky man, you have all the good things you need for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, be merry, enjoy yourself. So here he is thinking of himself being set for life, for this life. The man thought he had it made, but God said to him, "You fool, you fool. This very night you will have to give up your life. Then who will get these things that you have kept for yourself, these stuffed overflowing barns on your farm?" Well, we don't know if he had a family, but one thing's for sure, he ain't taking it with him. He can accumulate as much as he likes on earth, but he sure can't do a transfer to the other side. There's a story of two rich friends. One was dying, so he said to his friend, "Promise me that when I go, you'll put all my money in the ground with me. I don't want anyone else getting what I've worked so hard for." The friend promised to do as he was asked, so he was given the dying man's bank account details. Upon his death, the man withdrew all the money from that bank account and placed it in his own account. Then he wrote a check for the whole sum and he popped it in the coffin. Well, we could have as much cash as we want in the coffin, but it would still have no value. Of course, in the story, the man doesn't get to put his grand plan in place because his life ended that very day. And that's the reality, of course. We don't know from one day to the next when it's over down here. Some people have a better idea than others, but we don't know from day to day. Jesus concludes, "So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves but are not rich towards God." Now, he doesn't mean in this parable that if you're thinking about planning to invest only for yourself that you'll be struck down dead as a result. But rather, you need to refocus your life around being rich towards God rather than pursuing a selfish accumulation of riches for riches' sake. Because when the bell tolls for you, you need to be found focused on God. And focusing on God naturally leads us to be focused on others, on their needs. Oh yes, I see this parable does tie in with the parable of the Good Samaritan. The grace of God in Jesus, the Good Samaritan, leads us to respond with grace to the neighbour. The grace received leads to grace extended, to be turned away from self to the neighbour. Let's flesh this out a bit and personalise it. Dare we? "Fool," says Jesus. Strong word. Strong word. Is he talking to me? To you? Depends. Where are we focused? Me, me, me? Are we owned by our possessions or wealth? Or our desire for the same? Are we living rich towards God? Now, a rider and then a summary. In this parable, Jesus is not condemning wealth as such. Money itself is neutral. It's neither good nor evil. Luke has a bit of a preoccupation with talking about money and the rich and the poor. But a careful read of his gospel will show that it is the accumulation of wealth without regard for the needs of others that Jesus condemns. The use of wealth to help others, on the contrary, is commended. We need to just recall the story of Zacchaeus, who gave away half his possessions to the poor and repaid fourfold anything that he had gained by fraud. The problem for the man in Jesus' story was his selfish determination to keep it all for himself, rather than share what was really God's bountiful provision with others. That's the focal point which is brought out when Jesus says, so it is with those who store up for themselves, treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God. You see, to be rich towards God implies a generosity towards God's creation. Sharing rather than grasping, and generosity rather than greed. These are the things that express a richness towards God. When those who have received freely and abundantly, in turn freely and abundantly to give to others, they are rich towards the supreme giver. Freely, freely you have received. Freely, freely give. I wonder then if this does not suggest to us that a balanced life of discipleship requires a twofold response. Are we not in fact required to build our relationship with God and store up treasure in heaven by using all that God has resourced us with in being generous on earth? I believe it does. It's all too easy to get caught up in the desire to attain more and more wealth. There is a contagious affluenza epidemic at large, and anyone, including Christians, can easily catch it. Sadly, some even like being struck down by affluenza and justify it by claiming that financial riches are a blessing from God as a reward for faithfulness. Faith then becomes a means to get from God. But really, that does not sit at all well with what Jesus says here in this parable. The focus is not here on earth, but on heaven and on the things of the kingdom. This parable is about thinking about others, not ourselves. It's about generosity for generosity's sake, or for the kingdom's sake. It's about giving and not getting or selfishly hoarding. Too many people live like the rich fool. They are controlled by their wealth and their possessions. As a result, they are not free to be generous. Like the rich fool, they think only of themselves, and often as a result live miserable lives. But those who can free themselves from this control are usually the most content with their lot and more likely to be generous. And those who put their trust in God will be freest of all. Do not be a barn builder. Be a kingdom builder. That's the way to truly live. Amen.